It's 12:08. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, a Monday edition, January 9th. Winter is almost over. Not quite. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke are here, the Inno boys from Chicago Inno. And men, it's been a few weeks. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Too long, Steve.
Good to be back.
Too long, I know. Michael Heidemann, the producer, we were in the office before the show, and he was reviewing your names with me so that I would remember.
Yeah.
And so I think we did pretty well, Jim and Will.
I think you nailed it.
Okay, so I got to tell you, I have this real, and again, Michael and I were talking about this today. I hate talking about something that everyone else is doing. So we're coming up on auto show season.
Yeah.
I've never liked the auto shows, you know, and it's one of those things where I know why it happens, but every media outlet does all these interviews and blah, blah. It just bores me. And in a way, the Consumer Electronics Show is the same kind of thing because it's become this automatic week after Christmas or January 1st thing that everyone talks about.
Yeah, and it's kind of billed as a tech conference, but, you know, Steve, we're here every Monday. We're talking tech. We talk more about the business of tech, startups, what's happening in the city of Chicago that makes it easier or harder for startups to thrive, and who are these companies that are doing it. CES is gadgets.
Right,
okay. It is gadgets. It's toys. It is... The most important letter in CES is C. It's for consumers.
So how relevant is it to us as consumers?
How into gadgets are you? Are you a gadget guy?
Well, I'm not a gadget guy, but I mean, I'm thinking that a lot of the gadgets that are shown there are never going to actually come into my life.
I think that's going to change a little bit based on how the Internet of Things is sort of taking over all of your appliances. I mean, we saw that with one product with Samsung and Chicago-based Grubhub. They're partnering on a new version of Samsung's smart refrigerator that lets you order Grubhub from the
right.
LED screen
now,
on the refrigerator.
Again, I tend to be behind the curve on this, but... So in this Samsung refrigerator is one that you can, what, it has a window in it or it's got a camera in it so you can look through and see how much bologna you've got left.
That's right. So you
I used to open the door for that, Jim.
Well, you could be at the grocery store, pull up the app on your phone and take a look at the camera and
see,
there's no milk. Got to get some milk. So it's kind of silly on the surface, but actually when you think about it at the store, how many times have you been there and realized, oh, wait, now I've got two full cartons of milk now?
So that was the big trend, or one of the big trends at CES this year, was Internet of Things and smart devices aren't new. But as this kind of industry and space progresses and it becomes almost ubiquitous, the smarter things get. Because you're really only smart if you can talk to one another. So a smart toaster, when nothing else is smart around you, doesn't really work. But when your smart toaster can talk to your smart car and it knows that I am 5 minutes away from home, now I can get you your waffles ready, that's when things get a little smart. But the problem is the word smart on a lot of these devices. When there is value being added by the device, it's actually adding something that you, the human, can't do. Then I think that's a smart device. The problem is all of these devices are being called smart where really it's just lazy.
It's more nifty.
It's taking like the human ability of us to do things on our own away. So, Steve, we got a list of some of our favorite smart
items. Okay.
That we just think you'd absolutely love. And my favorite was the Spinali design with our smart shorts. And these shorts contain two vibrating sensors on the belt, which connect to the wearer's smartphone via Bluetooth, and it helps you navigate through urban environments by buzzing when they need to turn right or left. Those are smart shorts.
And that we play real or fake on this show.
These are all real.
So this is real.
We need to take a second and just talk about that one specifically, by the way. This helps you basically use navigation when you're walking around, but keep your phone in your pocket, and then your belt on the left side and the right side will buzz when you're trying to turn left or right. Literally, it's telling your pants or telling you when to turn.
Right. Well, their pants get us in trouble a lot of times. So maybe it can make it. I have a friend who grew up looking at his right thumb because he had a scar on his right thumb. So when he needed to know right from left, when he was learning, he would look for the scar and he knew that was right.
But I still kick an invisible soccer ball. No joke.
Really?
Just out of, yeah, because I have a natural... for some reason, I've always done that. I must have started when I was little, when I have to know left or right. I just like silently kick
so,
a
you might be in the market then for smart shorts. So
I'm
you
wearing
can,
them right now. They've been buzzing on stuff.
You won't be kicking your soccer balls anymore.
But Steve, there's the Kerastase Hair Coach, which is a smart airbrush. You're going to love this.
I don't think I am.
You're going to love it. It's equipped with sensors that provide information on the quality of hair and brushing patterns. It also features a microphone that listens to the sound of hair brushing in order to identify patterns that can give insights into manageability, frizziness, dryness, split ends, and breakage.
So isn't that what a mirror is for?
Merry belated Christmas, by the way.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate that. Okay, yeah. So a lot of times these things that look silly might be a precursor to something useful, but I don't see it in this case.
No, and Jim and I were talking about that before. Again, for me, if smart is something that is helping you, there is a smart cane that again connected to Bluetooth. But if the cane detects a fall, like it's been dropped or maybe someone fell using the cane,
right,
it automatically alerts your family. That's a smart device. That is adding value that only a digital product can. But things like your hairbrush listening to your hair, to your point, just use a mirror.
Right. And that's a little weird to me.
Yeah. So one of them that I actually kind of liked was this, the Power Ray. It's essentially like a smart fishing device. Think of it as kind of like an underwater drone. It's got a camera. You can sort of see the fish that are under there.
Uh-huh.
And then you can hook it, like press it. So you're basically kind of like playing video games underwater with fish, but you can hit the button, hook the fish, lure it up. So you can kind of very directly see the fish that are underneath there.
Wait, so instead of like the Ronco Pocket Fisherman, you know, you guys are too young for that. That was a TV before infomercials were such. They had a little like 8-inch rod and reel, mm-hmm, and you could, mm-hmm, cast out. So you're saying that I could put the drone in the water and then kind of attack the fish with my drone?
Treat it kind of like a submarine. Yeah. And so then you can sort of actively know where the fish are and hit, you know, reel them in and then try to hook them right from the screen.
Okay, but wait. So I'm looking at it. I'm looking at the screen, mm-hmm, and my drone, I don't have to put a bobber in the water. It's my drone that's going to hook the fish.
It will hook it for you.
Wow, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. That's kind of cool.
Yeah.
And their bill,
It's not a moto bag.
No. It's not motorized luggage, which is forever the greatest CES device of all time.
Okay, well, I think that could take off. But you got to have clearish water.
See, I like it because I fish every now and then, but it's just kind of boring. And every time I fish, I always get the like phantom tug at the line where, oh, right, got a nibble, got a bite, and always pull up and there's obviously nothing there.
Right.
But with the camera down there, you really kind of, it's a whole different fishing experience.
Yeah, but the whole point of fishing is to like have an activity that you're not looking at an LED screen, and this is just another thing that you're connected to a screen with.
Honest to God, you guys, when I woke up, the idea that the three of us would be talking about fishing underwater with a drone. It never occurred to me. Fish drones, right.
It's a more active fishing experience. I like it.
I guess so.
Well, one of the things, my nightmares about fishing was, I can remember clearly being in a boat with a couple of kids and a couple of dads, and the dads would get their line caught in a brush pile, and the kids would have to swim out and free it up, right? So I'm thinking the drones, there's got to be some risk there. Losing a drone that way.
Maybe, but now you could send the drone in the water to unhook the line. So maybe we could be in an environment where you have traditional poles and drones, so you can just use the drone to get it from the
brush. To look for underwater treasure or whatever. Not? Yeah,
yeah, right. You drop your class ring in the water, send down the fish drone. Okay, we got time for one more if we have a break. You guys have any other ones?
Or? Yeah, you know what? To get out of the silly realm, I do want to bring up a Chicago company, Tanvis, that is doing really amazing things. They're building haptic technology for smartphones and touchscreens. What that means is that they are allowing you to touch screens. So if you see a picture of a giraffe on your smartphone, you can pet your phone and it feels like a giraffe. Chicago is great at B2B pragmatic software. It's really cool to see the startups that are building those kind of CES dream technology. They are building the ability to touch your smartphone and feel it.
And the practical application being you can shop. So it's like online shopping. So if you want to feel what the fabric is going to be like when you buy it online, like, this fabric feels kind of uncomfortable to my skin or this feels soft, then you can buy it online that way.
Yeah, it's exciting times. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk, you know, and we were going to talk about this last Friday, and we just had all kinds of breaking news during the show. But the Facebook Live, you know, they're pushing Facebook Live. And obviously that was very much in the news last week. So I'm interested in you guys and your take on that. It's 12:21. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Steve Bertrand here on this Monday afternoon. Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke from Chicago Inno are in the studio as well. They come by on most Mondays, and I love it when they do because you guys are fun to talk to. People can read more about these stories at Chicago Inno.
ChicagoInno.com or subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Beat.
I was reading the newsletter. Jim, you must have been off. I think it was one with you and Karis recently. Yeah. About the CES, right?
Yeah.
Is it okay? Well, let's go. I talked about the fact that we were going to discuss this Facebook Live thing, and you know, it annoys me because they're pushing it so hard that you can't get away from it. I get all these notifications. I don't really care if some 12-year-old in Kansas City is doing a live post right now and all of that, but when it came to this attack last week on a disabled young man that was put live on Facebook, Facebook Live, they're certainly not responsible for it, but they had to see that stuff like this was probably coming.
So I think, one, it was a pretty jarring juxtaposition, right? We're all seeing, we live in the city, we all see these Facebook Live happy-go-lucky posters and billboards. I'm hoping this bus that's about to drive by has one on it, because you see that in Facebook should be more aware of this. When we were chatting about this on the newsletter, this is a bad trend for Facebook in that they continue to be surprised by people abusing their platform. Now, again, they are not responsible for bad users, but they are responsible for not thinking about all of these things that can happen. Twitter's the same way.
But what could they have done?
The same way with the fake news, right? Like, It took all of these stories to come out with an ability, a feature, a functionality, a tool that makes it easy to flag questionable content. So the problem that this stuff like this might always appear on the platform, but it shouldn't be allowed to go viral. That's a problem, that it takes so long for these sites to catch it and pull it. If anything, these platforms are built to just accelerate and fuel the spread of content. My concern is that they're not, these catch safes, these kind of like fire alarms are put in after the fact. These are the smartest people in technology.
So they should have seen this coming and had that fire alarm in place before.
I think so. Listen, we live in way too complicated a world to tell Facebook and Twitter to stop making quote unquote guns. But they need to have safeties on them. You need to put safeties on these devices.
But it also, too, is a bit of a double-edged sword. I mean, clearly when Facebook Live broadcasts a live video like that, it's objectionable content that they otherwise would not want their users to see. On the same token, though, a lot of it is used as a transparency tool for policing. I mean, right? I mean, we've seen police-involved shootings that are captured on Facebook Live, and this is used to help sort of figure out what happened in a crime. I mean, it's a useful tool to sort of understand what truly is happening, especially as a tool for police to help help with the situation.
Yeah, but it's also just reflective of the kind of Silicon Valley bubble where just because they think that their technology is this idealistic creation that's helping the world and humanity, they just need to be smarter about what it's being used for. Like, the fact that Facebook was surprised by fake news is just, you need to lock yourself in a boardroom and think about, okay, what are the worst case scenarios for our technology, and what can we do to make sure that it doesn't spiral? Twitter, again, is not responsible for the trolls on this platform, but it took them 10 years to introduce a mute button. That's this kind of dangerous trend where you have to be so fast, you have to move so quickly.
Do you think it's because they're chasing the bucks so fast, or that they're running forward so fast, or that they're just a little
thick-headed? I think part of the reason is that, you know, these platforms want to be a sort of beacon of free speech, and so they very much want people to kind of be able to express themselves, you know, and they put themselves as a platform that way. I mean, that's why Twitter has been so hard to take off the abuse on there, because they still want to be a platform that says, you know, we're not going to ban people's free speech. So I think you get into some very dicey territory when you're sort of deciding, okay, this is a video that needs to be shown, it needs to be out in the public, or this is a video that is truly sort of objectionable, we need to kind of hide this from other people. It is a difficult line to balance.
It feels too easy to abuse these platforms. Mm-hmm. And that to me is it's a very complicated issue, but I'm also not an engineer making $280,000 a year, right?
Okay, like, so let me do it this way, because for me, to me, and I'm even further from the engineering than you are, it's magic that they can have a machine somewhere spot a video that looks like it might be objectionable and pull it. But you're saying that they should and do have the technology that would have seen this attack. Well, flagged it and pulled it.
Or you allow the users to be able to flag it quickly. So the first person to see that sees it, it immediately goes to Facebook. And that's what's happening with Facebook News, is we, the users, have the ability to flag something that's questionable that then gets reviewed. So this just wasn't in place. But yes, there is that technology. Marketers have been using video recognition software to like comb all of the videos on YouTube and find all of the ones where someone's holding a Coca-Cola can or a Budweiser can. That technology is in place. Again, should Facebook be using that to decide what's questionable, what's not? No, but it should be easier to spot so it doesn't go viral.
That's Will Flanagan and Jim Dahlke, both here from Chicago Inno. Check out Chicago Inno. Men, good to see you again. We'll do it again next Monday.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:37. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. The tune is Randy. Randy Schaefer is here from the Chicago Tribune. Writes about social media. Welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Well, thank you. It's good to be back.
Yeah, you know, with the holidays and everything, I was just talking to the Inno boys. We haven't been together. I haven't seen you in a few weeks either.
Yeah, I've been keeping busy.
Okay, so let's jump right into this. Syracuse professor wrote an op-ed. When I was in college, you know, the journalism students would look at the people who wanted to be on TV and like, well, they're not really interested in journalism. They just want to be stars on TV and all of that. And so there was that sort of friction. Now he writes about these college kids who come in and they don't necessarily want to be journalists or radio or TV people. They want to be internet. They want to be influencers.
Right. Influencers is kind of the new buzzword. You know, kids, they don't want to be actresses. They don't want to be movie stars or rock stars. They want to be influencers.
And what is an influencer?
An influencer is somebody that is basically social media famous. So kind of like a lesser version of Kim Kardashian.
Right. And
without the drama.
And, you know, I think those of us who aren't plugged into that, and I, you know, I'm on social media, but not in that way, there are lots of these people. I mean, hundreds of these people.
Yeah, absolutely. And they're on every single site. They're on Instagram. They're on YouTube. They used to be on Vine until Vine shut down. And these kids are kind of the ones calling the shots. You know, it's a lot easier from a marketing perspective to reach out to a kid and be like, hey, you know, you want to promote this product to your peers instead of sponsoring an ad. You know, if Ford sponsors a car and it shows up in your timeline, that's not cool. But if your best friend Lisa just got a Ford car, then you want a Ford car.
If the influencer who has 100,000 or 200,000 or 300,000 followers, there's more of an allegiance to them. It's almost, it's a
Absolutely.
Celebrity endorsement.
It very much is.
And so the thing that is difficult for me sometimes to understand is how they become that. I mean, what is it, what their appeal is that draws all of these listeners?
Well, for
or,
a lot
not
of
listeners,
it,
but, you know, followers.
I know what you mean. Yeah. For a lot of it, it's kind of that they're relatable. You know, these kids are, they do what you do, but they do it better. And they do it all the time, and they have all eyes on them. And it's just that these kids are so relatable. And I think that's what makes them famous, and that's what draws the ads to draws the ads.
But
to
do
them.
These influencers, I mean, do they like, in this piece the professor wrote about, he wrote about a girl in his class, a woman in his class, who is, you know, student by day, and by night she's posting these sort of slice of life, not, I don't want to say not that interesting, but not that dramatic videos that picked up all of these hundreds of thousands of followers. I guess my question is, do these influencers set out to be so, or are they created by their content?
That's kind of an interesting question. I think some people definitely set out to become famous, but some people, it kind of just happens. I can see it going both ways.
Right. Okay. So I want to be an influencer, Randy. Can you make it happen? What do I need to do?
You need to get on Instagram and start posting hundreds of photos and make sure you're targeting all of the cool kids in high school.
And then the cool kids will follow me, and the cool kids who follow them will follow them.
if they like what you're posting, yes.
And before you know it, I'll be arrested for having all sorts of cool kids following me.
Let's not take it that far.
We'll have to go a different route.
Dial it back a bit.
Another story that you pulled from the Washington Post has to do with these disclaimers and the language in it. I love this because, you know, I signed up for something, I think, today. Or it was yesterday. I was buying tickets for the Marquette basketball game next week. And to do so, I had to join the Marquette Ticket Club or whatever. And, you know, then there's this, I click next and it doesn't work. I'm like, oh, yeah, I got to check this box. And the box was me giving away every...
And you definitely read the terms and conditions, right?
Of course I
did. Every single word of them.
No one ever reads those terms and conditions.
No, they don't.
And that's the point of it, that these the people who looked at it, so many people online, social media, are young kids who have no idea the privacy that they are sacrificing when they click that. Frankly, none of us do. I mean, I click the box.
Right, absolutely.
I feel like I don't care, but... There's this movement to make kids more aware of what they're giving away.
Yeah, and then that's what's kind of going on with this, is a lawyer rewrote Instagram's terms of service in trying to avoid legalese and making it more kid-friendly. They actually analyzed Instagram's terms of service and found that they read at a postgraduate level. And Instagram requires you to be 13 to have an account. And I don't really know a lot of 13-year-olds that read at a postgraduate level.
I don't know a lot of adults who read at a postgraduate.
Right.
So that's the point. So you're joining Instagram. There's the terms and conditions. If you were to read them, which were, what, 7 pages or something like that?
Something like that.
And it's written at a level beyond most of our grasp. Not only are we not interested, we're not going to be able to follow it if we are.
Right. And then in the worst case scenario, you're going to end up with a human sense iPad South Park occurrence. Have you seen that episode?
No, I have not.
Oh, long story short, Kyle checks the terms and conditions without reading them, and he's abducted and forced into a human sense iPad experiment. So.
Yeah. Well, that's exactly what I was fearing. But so... So Instagram has rewritten this, right? Or these professors did?
These professors did. Instagram didn't do it. It was done independently, just kind of as an experiment. And it turns out that a lot of kids didn't really know that, you know, Instagram can read all of your direct messages. And so some of these kids kind of read these rewritten terms and thought, hey, maybe I should take a better look at these kind of things in the future.
So is there any indication that these social media platforms are going to rewrite their terms and conditions?
Probably not. I mean, these terms and conditions, as I'm sure you know, are vetted by tons of lawyers
That's
and attorneys,
thing, right.
And they kind of have to write them that way, but always a good reminder to give them a quick skim.
I saw one of the rewrites, and they took this huge paragraph of legalese, and the rewrite was, don't do horrible things to other
right.
people
don't
online.
Don't be mean.
Right. Well, that's not going to quite cover when it comes to
exactly.
a court of law, I would imagine. All right. Well, we'll see where that goes. President Obama's in town tomorrow for his farewell address, and he's going to be eclipsed instantly when it comes to Twitter, but with the next president. But he was the most Twitter-friendly president, by and large, because he's been so far almost the only Twitter president.
Right.
I suppose it was around before with George W. for a time. But there was a piece in The Atlantic arguing that maybe he embraced social media a little bit too much.
Well, and that piece was kind of critical about President Obama's use of social media, saying that maybe President Obama was too good at it, and because he openly embraced these technologies, you know, man always had his BlackBerry in his hand, maybe it made the rest of us too dependent on social media. I don't really buy that.
No, I think the president might have influence on a lot of people in a lot of ways, but Twitter was going to be Twitter without him.
With or without him.
But it's interesting that they came up with this archive project, right? And they created at POTUS. And so he didn't make it personal. And he will hand over not only the handle to President Trump when the president takes office, but also all of those followers.
All those followers, yeah. All of his tweets are going to be archived. There's actually, the White House did a very cool blog post on it at the beginning of the year, late last year, talking about what's going to happen to the president's social media following. And Donald Trump is going to be taking over the POTUS handle and all of those followers pretty quickly. It's coming up.
But, you know, there certainly are people who follow at POTUS to want to know what's going on in government. But I would imagine a vast majority of them follow because they're fans of Barack Obama. So you're going to have this sort of crash of waves of pro-Obama people all of a sudden following President Trump and getting the Trump tweets.
There's going to be a lot of unfollowing and a lot of refollowing. I'm not sure if Donald Trump is planning on continuing to tweet from his real Donald Trump handle, or if he's just going to fully migrate over to the POTUS handle. So it's definitely going to be interesting to watch.
What do you think is going to happen?
I think that he's going to try to maintain both of them.
I do, too.
I think that the POTUS one might have a little bit more of his staff and administration support on it, but those are just my guesses.
Yeah, I think he's going to want to find a way to make people know when he is speaking and the best way to do that. I mean, why would you give up that many followers in that account?
Exactly.
Randy Schaefer writes about social media for the Chicago Tribune, and people can follow you at, what's your Twitter handle?
Randy M. Schaefer.
Randy M. Schaefer. All right. Thanks very much for coming
by. Thank you for having me.
It's the Business Lunch. You're listening. Oh, when we come back, we're going to talk about this story that really intrigues me. It's a case before the state Supreme Court later this week about hospitals. Some of them are making hundreds of millions of dollars a year, but they don't pay property taxes. Now, their argument is, hey, we are doing charity work that equates with the amount of money we would pay in taxes. We're giving that away in free care to the indigent, to people who couldn't afford it otherwise. It's an even balance. Well, Urbana is suing over that. They've got the Carle Clinic in Urbana, and the state Supreme Court will hear arguments on that later this week. We will talk about that with reporter Lisa Schenkner from the Chicago Tribune coming up in just a couple of minutes. This is the Biz Lunch on 720 WGN. It's 12:50. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Lisa Schenker is in the studio. She writes for the business section of the Chicago Tribune. And I think it's your first time on the program. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you.
So you had a piece in the Tribune yesterday talking about this hearing coming up before the state Supreme Court a little bit later this week. I think it's on Thursday, right?
Yes, Thursday.
And the issue is whether the hospitals in Illinois should be exempt from paying property taxes.
Right. There's a state law right now that says not-for-profit hospitals can be exempt from paying property taxes so long as the value of their charitable care is as much or exceeds their tax liability.
So the idea is the hospitals say, look, we take anyone who comes in. We take the people who can't necessarily afford to have us treat them. We pay for their treatment, and in exchange for that, we should get a pass on property taxes.
Essentially, right. They say they're charitable. They have charitable missions, and they're not looking to make a profit. They'll treat anyone, so they shouldn't have to pay property taxes.
But Lisa, they do make a profit, don't they?
Well, it depends on how you define profit.
Is that right?
I mean, I think a lot of people would say yes, they do make a profit because they have a net income. They have what they call a margin, which most people would think of as a profit margin. They just don't call it that because they're not-for-profit institutions.
So their net profit is called their margin?
They call it the margin or net income.
And with some of these hospitals, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars.
We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars for sure across the state and across the Chicago area.
So here comes Urbana. I grew up in Kankakee County, so when you got really sick back when I was growing up, you go down to Carle Clinic in Champaign. It's in Urbana. Urbana says, look, we got this big hospital complex. We could use the cash to hire some more police officers. We need the property tax revenue from them. So they took Carle Clinic to court. And that's the case we're hearing.
Yeah, there's actually, this case has been going on. It's been going back and forth for quite a while. There have been legal actions in both directions. And right now, the state Supreme Court is kind of the latest of where they've ended up after a long time going back and forth in the courts on this.
And so is this the sort of case, can they go to the U.S. Supreme Court, or will it be resolved with the state Supreme Court?
It will likely be resolved with the state Supreme Court, or the state Supreme Court might kick it back to a lower court.
And so 156 of Illinois' more than 200 hospitals are characterized as this, as not-for-profit hospitals. We're talking about the big ones, right? Advocate, Northwestern, Rush, and little ones as well.
Right. I mean, the vast majority of hospitals in Illinois are not-for-profit.
And so we're talking about these, some of them that are doing very well and have a margin of, you know, one of the stories, I don't remember which one, was like $300 million or something. But that doesn't mean every hospital is doing well, right? And there are hospitals in smaller towns, not-for-profit hospitals, whose margins are much smaller. So the idea that I can paint all of these conglomerates as, you know, coming with huge net profits every year, that's not necessarily the case.
Right. If you talk to the Illinois Health and Hospital Association, that's what they'll tell you, that 40% of the hospitals in the state are either on slim or negative margins. I mean, you look at a system like Presence, and, you know, they've been struggling. This is not a system that is enjoying hundreds of millions of dollars in profit in recent years.
And so what do you think is going to happen? Predict.
In this
she
court case...
She recoils, right? I mean, that's the worst thing to ask a reporter.
I mean, gosh, if I could predict the outcome, that would be pretty great. But I think, you know, there's a lot of speculation about which way this could go. No one knows if they're going to rule the law unconstitutional or not. The lower court ruled it unconstitutional in this case that ended up before the state Supreme Court. But then there was another Illinois appellate court that recently upheld the law. So it could go in either direction, or they might kick it back to a lower court and say, you figure this out.
Well, you know, in a way, in your piece, you did predict the outcome, because even after the court rules, let's say the court rules for the municipalities and against the hospitals, the hospitals have a lot of different avenues that they can go to try to thwart this, right, or try to avoid paying these property taxes.
Right. I mean, the Illinois Health and Hospital Association tells me that some hospitals might still be able to keep their exemptions, even if this law is ruled unconstitutional, because there's another law they might be able to continue having their exemptions under. It's also possible, if the court rules this unconstitutional, that the Illinois Health and Hospital Association will work with lawmakers to craft a new law that would not be unconstitutional.
Right. So there's an old law that says that hospitals can get exemptions if they're owned by charitable institutions.
Right. And so
would that be churches, or?
That's a good question. I mean, there's a whole nother question. How do you define that?
A charitable organization. So here we are with this big question facing us, and we know municipalities could certainly use the cash, and a hearing coming up on Thursday, and the promise of any clarity after that hearing might not be as hopeful as we'd think.
Right. We'll just have to wait and see.
What kind of timeline are we looking at from the state Supreme Court? I mean, do they, I think of the U.S. Supreme Court and their rulings coming late in the year generally. How long would it take the Supreme Court to rule in Illinois? Do you have any idea?
It won't come immediately. Whether it's weeks or months, I'm not 100% sure. We'll have
right.
to see.
So a lot of money at stake, and it's property taxes. It's what we pay. The municipalities say we could use this for other reasons, and the hospital saying, well, we're already using the money. We're using it to pay the poor, and if we don't pay for the poor, someone's going to have to do that down the road. Fair summary?
Essentially, yeah.
All right, Lisa Schenkner, thanks very much for coming by today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's the Business Lunch on 720 WGN. That's going to wrap things up for the Business Lunch on this Monday afternoon. Thanks very much for tuning in. I appreciate that. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter at Steve Bertrand. Also, I don't know if you watch the Golden Globes, but in my house, it's kind of, I've become the pariah when it comes to going to movies, because I just hate these new luxurious theaters. And I know that people love the recliners and everything, but they have so shrunken the number of tickets available to see movies that it's hard for me now, to where I live, to go see a movie. I've got to choose a date in advance. It's like I'm going to see Hamilton or something. We're going to talk to Ryan Fonder tomorrow. He writes about business and the movies for the LA Times, and he'll talk about those luxurious theaters and also other ways the movie companies are trying to get your bucks in these days of television, the great TV shows on Netflix and Amazon and all of that. We'll go to the movies with Ryan tomorrow on the Business Lunch. Right now, time for a check of the news. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com.